Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. TGIF, but thank God for all days, actually. But we know a lot of us are glad that it's Friday. And we are looking forward to hopefully entertaining, enjoyable, safe weekend. And we want to talk about some news, try to get an update or perspective on some immigration news from immigration attorney Nadine Brown. Good morning, Nadine. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. Thank you. I'm doing well.
Great. You? Thank you for joining us again, gracing us with your presence and making time in your busy schedule. Nadine is a true friend of G's Power Hour. She actually agreed last minute to join us this morning, and we appreciate it because there's, I guess, growing news on the border. Can you enlighten us a little bit, please?
So border crisis is still a thing, not just along the, California, Arizona, New Mexico border, but in Texas as well. And the numbers are swelling because of the things that are happening around the world, and particularly in our region of the globe. Many are aware because we watch the news and we have friends or family members or people in our community who are affected by the events in the Caribbean, natural disasters, the hurricanes and the earthquakes. And so with the Texas border crisis that's heating up a bit is the influx of migrants that are still on their way, particularly because of the earthquakes that happened recently in Haiti and the other political events, the assassination of their president not too long ago. So I believe it was breaking news yesterday that a majority of the individuals coming across the Texas border or trying to get in were Haitian nationals who were fleeing Haiti because of the devastation due to the earthquakes and the political turmoil and unrest and just general unease of the climate that's there. So they said, I believe it was reported 70% at least were Haitian nationals that they could determine that need to be processed, and Border Patrol was overwhelmed with just the sheer numbers of individuals trying to get in.
I guess one of my concerns is that someone's going to get hurt as I looked at some of the pictures, and because I'm looking at these desperate people on one side trying to get in, trying to make their lives better, and then I see our people trying to, you know, guard our borders, protect our borders. Very few of them, proportionately, but they have these guns, and I'm like, I'm just hoping
it's
that
it's a dangerous situation. It's you have to try to see both perspectives of the event or the crisis. I mean, they're, you know, people who are generally concerned, who are American citizens. I guess the disappointing feature is, you know, with Texas gun laws the way that they are and then the culture around gun violence, it is very concerning and disturbing that you have vigilantes or militia homegrown that are trying to assist the Customs and Border Protection agents but they're not deputies. So, you know, they're making individual determinations because of their own perception of what is a danger to their, you know, land or their territory or their property or their safety. And a lot of it has to do sometimes with misinformation. So there's that on the one side. So you do have a right to protect yourself and your property. However, what length do you go? And this is why we have a system of laws and due process and should have an orderly process of determining who gets to come in. And on the other side, you have desperate people who may not be aware of what the local news is saying, may not be conscious of the danger that they may pose or how they're being perceived, and they're just singularly, you know, focused on survival. So when you're in survival mode and all you can think about is either getting out of the danger that you're presently in because you perceive immediate harm, whether it's to life or to your loved ones, then I don't think a lot of other things matter. So if you're coming on foot and you've weathered the terrain and the anxiety, frustration, and fear and terror that you may have experienced on your journey, and you're at a land crossing, you just want to get in and you don't have a consciousness or awareness that there may be a process, whether there's a language barrier or it's a systemic issue that you have to go through the proper channels. And so if you're found yourself in a situation where, you know, a lot of the people in Haiti were then homeless because of the earthquakes, buildings are toppling and they don't necessarily have building codes and contractors and personnel that are going to go out and make sure that the codes are, everything is up to code or that it's, you know, rebuildable. And you're hungry, you're thirsty, or your loved one needs care, you're going to go to the place where you think that is. It's just like anybody that is here. So on a human basic level, it's these people are seeking survival and, you know, life. Liberty and the pursuit of happiness are those things that the U.S. Constitution says that we have a fundamental right to, and that extends beyond our borders. At least that's how we promote this democracy. So that's what a lot of people are thinking. Give me my life, my liberty, and my happiness. And on the other side, we're thinking the same thing. So, you know, in our culture right now, it's dueling objectives, goals, and ideals, and we're all seeking the same thing. So it's unfortunate that we feel, you know, under siege, both sides, one trying to get in because they're looking for the same things that we are, and they think here is it. And on the other side, it's we're trying to protect what we have because some of us have a scarcity or lack mentality that there's not enough for us, and that there should be an orderly process, and there just isn't. When you have, you know, chaos and confusion because of the pandemic, lack of leadership, and not knowing what to do when you get to the borders, it becomes problematic. So our southern border is no different than people who, you know, were fleeing Afghanistan or still trying to get out, you know, a few weeks ago to the present day, and others in other parts of the world who are also, you know, seeking refuge, whether it's through, you know, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, the Mediterranean, you know, Greece, and people trying to flee Syria or North Africa. By any route, those countries, any country that has the perception of being wealthy or having resources is going to encounter groups of individuals who want to get in and participate and receive some of the benefits of living here.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I was going to say that, you know, I just hope that everybody's, you know, no matter what their circumstances, are able to practice some patience and self-control on all sides, because it's tough no matter what side you're on. But, you know, yeah, like you're saying, you know, everybody's trying to, you know, people that are coming over here are trying to look out for their basic human needs. Let me ask you this, though, you know, from what you perceive, why is it, you know, we've seen, let's say, in history where people have had adverse circumstances in their own country, and they uprise and turn things over and establish a new rule of law that benefits the people in those countries. Why do you think that instead of working together to improve the circumstances in their own country, that a lot of these people decide that it's I guess, easier maybe or of more benefit to travel over here?
Sometimes I think it is a matter of perceived power or lack thereof. So if you're in a country where there's not good infrastructure or people are corrupt because they have corrupt motives or incredible mismanagement, you know, you can protest, and we've seen protests around the world in different countries and the government's reactions to those protests. Some of it is military crackdown with the repressive laws that burden civil rights of individuals. So unlike the U.S. where, you know, we have freedom to assembly and the freedom of speech that kind of protects us to an extent, and we know that there may or may not be repercussions from that as far as a judicial process where we're being prosecuted for, you know, civil disobedience, just like in the civil rights era. There are consequences that, you know, people encounter that risk life and limb. Not everybody wants to be a martyr. But yes, people have the ability to protest and to rise up, and I guess it depends on how bad it's perceived and how much power they think they have, and also the alliances that they can build, because, you know, one person can change the world. However, when you're talking about regimes and oppressive governments, it becomes overwhelming. It's just like all of the non-governmental groups that we have that are still trying to eradicate poverty and hunger. And we're the richest country, or one of, in the world, and we still have people here who are hungry and poor and don't have certain amenities that we consider a part of basic human rights, food, shelter, and clothing. So, you know, it would be great, and it's very idealistic, and it would be wonderful if people in their countries, whether it was Haiti or, you know, El Salvador or Guatemala or Honduras, in Syria or Afghanistan were to rise up, but we know that a lot of the battle and the war is won in the minds of the individuals who are being oppressed and victimized. And if you perceive that you have no power or you have no weapons, then where are you going to be? The sheer numbers is like how many people were enslaved or are being trafficked, and they don't know that, you know, they have a certain power before you start to manipulate people to think, okay, well, even if you try to rebel or try to fight back, then we will just kill you. And that's a lot of times what happens in oppressive regimes. If you know the history in our region, you know, in the Caribbean and a lot of Latin America, when you have these despots and tyrants that were ruling, it was with heavy military might, you know, unlike the administration that just left that was, you know, admired North Korea and some of the oppressive regimes, Duterte in the Philippines and, you know, Erdogan in Turkey and some of the leaders across the globe who are not necessarily, you know, democratic thinking individuals. If you're feeling oppressed or repressed, or you use your military might to really undermine the concept of freedom and democracy, then you've won in the minds of the people that you're victimizing. So that's how you keep people down, is really in their minds, helping them to know that they have no power or they have no hope. And so that's why the borders will be bursting when you think that America is still a symbol of hope. And so that's what people cling to. But, you know, there are some movements, whether it starts with the university students or it's just people who are pushing back because they feel empowered through social media or underground mechanisms. But is it enough to do government change, especially when the vote is not guaranteed to everybody and there are people who steal elections all the time? And we had in our country a riot that, you know, demonstrated that there were people unhappy with the vote or the voting process or the voting system, and they tried to undermine it or question it. And we're a democracy that tries to promote that around the globe. So you can only imagine that even if you try it in your own country, some people feel helpless, some people feel hopeless, and some people have the idea that it'll only get you but so far.
We're going to take a quick break. We are here with immigration attorney Nadine Brown. If you have questions, the number is 516-387-1944. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment, and we will be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Hi, I'm Tim Garris. You may know me as Timmy G. Yeah, I know. It's been 2 decades, but I want you to know I'm back in the Arglitex. And I've got a mix of music that can help you relax and chill out. It's smooth. It's relaxing. It's chill out jazz. The soulful mix of smooth jazz, soul, and smooth R&B. So join me every Wednesday night, 10 p.m. to midnight, on K-Ham Radio.
Are you chilling?
Good morning. Welcome back to G's Power Hour. I've never had it so good entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are here talking immigration issues with attorney Nadine Brown. And so, Nadine, I wanted to ask you about a little bit about what you might know about an article I saw about immigrants in U.S. detention exposed to hazardous disinfectants every day. This particular article came out of Scientific American. And it was saying that on August 26th, a complaint was filed on behalf of detainees at the Glades County Detention Center in Florida, which holds people for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, citing ongoing issues of a highly toxic chemical disinfectant, sometimes used multiple times a day, alongside living conditions which are insanitary, hostile, and unsafe. Are you aware of with regards to the dousing of immigrants with disinfectants that have caused, according to this article, like breathing problems and bleeding?
So I had not heard of this specific issue until you sent me the article, and I just glanced through it and actually was reviewing it. A little while ago, but I do know that in a lot of the detention facilities across the U.S. that COVID has been a problem, the spread of disease, and in some instances, small cases of TB. And we know that we're in an environment right now where disease is on the rise. So, I mean, COVID is one indicator, but with the anti-vax and misinformation on social media and just in social circles, a lot of people are not prioritizing their health or immunotherapies or immunizations, so that becomes problematic. And what's happening in the detention facilities in particular is because people are being housed in a lot of times unsafe and unsanitary, crowded conditions. They're becoming ill, whether it's with respiratory illnesses in general, TB, or which is tuberculosis, or with COVID. Some of the facilities may have policies that are blanket in nature to try to, quote-unquote, disinfect or sanitize the facilities with little concern for the actual environmental safety of the individuals that they're treating. So, they may spray or use, germicides that may be used not in a human context, maybe for livestock or for, pesticides for crops, because they don't know any better. I mean, you have people that are taking, livestock medication because of whatever they've heard in their circles to cure, quote-unquote, cure COVID or manage COVID. Because people have reduced science to nothing, or it's just a process, and they can't understand heads or tails of it. So I would not doubt that this story is genuine and authentic. It's problematic because these are human beings, but we know that immigrants have the lowest priority when it comes to health and safety. And if the stories coming out of the border detention facilities were any indication of how the children were being treated during the Trump administration, lacking basic sanitation, water, soap, deodorant, toothpaste, then I wouldn't doubt that these things probably do occur. And why they would, you know, implement policies like this is because who's really going to care unless you have a family member that's being detained and being abused in such a way, grotesque, you know, human rights violations at the very least. And some of the facilities are still privatized or contracted out through the federal government, and the oversight and regulation, as we know, there's still a lot of pushback in Congress for that. So as much as the budget is being wrestled with and, you know, people are getting allowances to manage this population, there's not going to be a lot of oversight. So whether it's in Florida or Texas, Georgia, California, Mexico, New Mexico, or, you know, Washington State or New York, it is likely that they're going to have individuals who abuse the process and whole schemes of organizations that get over just because they can and nobody's going to report. Or by the time you discover what is happening, it's either too late because the people have been injured physically, you know, either, you know, lung damage, or we know from the previous detention stories of the migrant women that were abused and sterilized with a lot of times without their knowledge, that is something that happens. I mean, abuse can occur when no one's watching, or people who are doing the abuse don't think the victims or the survivors are going to say or do anything to get them in trouble. So it's unfortunate that, you know, they're using disinfectants, but I don't know what the motivation behind it, other than it's just cruel and unusual punishment, if there was anything, because we can provide routine care, we just choose not to.
Okay. It's hard to know what to say about that, but I mean, like you said,
it's
just basic care.
It's like, okay, a fundamental basic right for any human being should be medical care or medical treatment. But if we, as American citizens or people who are legally here, are struggling with that now, can you imagine how much lesser so for the individuals who are perceived to have no rights? So if we can't, you know, we think we can walk into an urgent care and everything is great, or we can walk into a hospital, but we know that the treatment and the care that you received are dependent on a variety of variables: social status, wealth, you know, racial and ethnic heritage, and depending on where you live and what access you have to medical or basic care. And so if we have not yet determined this is a fundamental right that you have to just basic medical care and access to medicines or therapies that can help you be healthy, then immigrants are on the lowest rung. They're not going to get any more care than we would.
Okay, so last week, the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Ken Salazar, arrived in Mexico, and I guess this is a new post for him. And one of the things, I guess, that my understanding is that they're continuing to ask, you know, I guess Mexico with their help in terms of manning the southern border. I want to ask, is it that difficult to get cooperation from Mexico with this, number one? Number two, wouldn't you think that this influx of people through Mexico to the U.S.-Mexico border actually does put some sort of inconvenience or burden or taxes, resources on them as well, even if they're just letting them pass through because, you know, people have to have places to eat, people have to have places to stay, and they may be camping out in places where they shouldn't. Can you talk a little bit about the U.S.-Mexico relations with regards to that and what is expected of our ambassador there that would make a difference?
So a part of diplomacy is getting people to take responsibility or to assist as allies, and a lot of times we have not done a very good job in supporting, you know, other nations, and our history of geopolitical presence has been dominance, and essentially demanding or telling other people what they should be doing. So it's great if we can have a collaborative approach to, you know, this is a regional issue when it comes to southern border crisis or northern border crisis, because we don't talk about what happens with Canada other than, hey, you know, Justin Trudeau is doing a wonderful job at least keeping his people there, and, yeah, there are people coming across the north, but it's really what should Mexico do. And I think we lose sight of the fact that, you know, what our history has been in the geopolitical context, and then, two, our expectations, they are reasonable, as you stated, to have Mexico kind of participate in stemming the tide or at least dealing with it, but you also have to understand Mexican culture. Whereas here we have still a reasonable middle class. Sometimes in other countries, Mexico in particular, you have a more stratified social structure where it's either the haves or the have-nots. And it's, you know, people are doing well or they're doing not so well. And the not so well, the government is like, okay, well, we have, you know, infrastructure and supports. But if there are people coming across here and they can't even contain their own indigenous population or their own unskilled labor population or the poorer classes, it doesn't matter who is coming in or who is not. I mean, geographically, Mexico is a huge country. So whether it's their soldiers or their police that is able to patrol their borders also becomes problematic, and they have people pouring in from the south as well, coming across from Guatemala, because a lot of Central Floridians are dealing with the influx of Central Americans, from Guatemala and from Honduras, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Mexico can do but so much, but, you know, they have their own structure and perception of what they should be doing in the last administration. And because, you know, we rotate and we swing the pendulum back and forth with they're our friends, they're not our friends, we're going to be frenemies, we're not going to be frenemies, and we're going to help each other, and we may have, you know, trade treaties and what have you, but when it comes to the people coming through the borders, they can do but so much, but they know that that's not their final destination. So like tourists coming in, you're just here for a minute. You can use and, you know, contribute to our economy, and then you move on because it's very transitory. So everybody's trying to get to the United States, and if they come through Mexico, you can't. You know, unlike the Customs and Border Patrol that is a little bit more sophisticated, they're not going to be, you know, tagging migrants and following migrants and apprehending migrants. They may, but, you know, their jail system and their registration system is not going to be as intricate as ours could be. So they could do but so much, and I'm hoping that our ambassador could create a better atmosphere for working with Mexican rather than alienating them or criticizing to get cooperation moving forward. So there is more that they probably could do, but are they the complete answer? Probably not. A lot of it sometimes just has to do with the migrants themselves that are coming in and what choices they make and what information they have. And some people are just not sophisticated enough and just determined to come anyway. So, you know, you can do what you can do to create obstacles and a system by which they can get in orderly. But when everybody's in crisis, then you may have a mob situation where people are just flooding the borders because of the sheer numbers. And, you know, not everybody's going to be detected, not everybody's going to be apprehended, not everybody's going to be processed, and so you still have people coming in through Mexico mm-hmm. by boat and plane and overstaying.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I have more questions for Nadine. We're here with immigration attorney Nadine Brown here. She's located in Winter Springs, right? Is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if you have questions for Nadine, the number today for the show is 516-387-1944. This is Gee's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment, and we will be right back.
This is Douglas Dobbs of Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community for 29 years with quality funeral and cremation services. Honoring all religions and faiths, we have been here for many grieving families. Whether it's a complete funeral service with a burial or a simple, dignified cremation, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here for you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Having a wedding, reception, family reunion, planning a banquet, or some other fundraising event. Need to share your knowledge through a workshop or seminar. Or it's a difficult time and you need to plan a wake or repast. Let us help. At our gatherings, let us reduce the stress and make the occasion memorable, treasured. Call our gatherings at 407-968-9387 or email ourgatherings@yahoo.com. Let us help plan your special event.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are here with immigration attorney Nadine Brown. If you have questions, the number is 516-387-1944. Nadine, I was wondering how much of an impact can the United States have or any other countries have? Because I'm thinking, too, even though we have immigrants coming into this country, some of them pass through and end up in Canada as well. And what I wanted to know is how much of an impact can the United States and maybe even Canada have on getting Mexico to be a little bit tougher on their border, you know, their southern border protections. One of the reasons I'm asking also is because my understanding is quite a few, and not that we don't want to help. And let me just put this out there. Not that, you know, everybody is feeling, I'm saying everybody should, let me just put it that way, feeling the pain of what's going on in Haiti and some of these other countries. And so my understanding, though, there's a significant number of Haitians that are coming in from Mexico, that along this border underpass where a lot of these people are showing on the news this morning that are trying to find shelter from the heat and the rain and everything else, a lot of them are coming in from Haiti because of the natural disasters and the governmental, breakdown there as well. So can you talk a little bit about that, please?
So, Haiti was an independent nation for the longest time in this particular corner of the globe, but they have ties to France and to Canada. And so a lot of people do secondary and tertiary migration. So a lot of Haitians would go to France or would go to Quebec because that's a French speaking region of Canada or may have family members there. But they sometimes don't know how to get there. I mean, after the first earthquake in 2010, a lot of them traveled to countries that were accepting of them and providing work authorization. So you still have a lot of people that went to Brazil or Colombia or Venezuela in South America. And then, are trying to get in by foot because they determined that if they weren't able to get a visa through the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince, which has, since been closed or is only processing paperwork for immediate relatives of U.S. citizens, then they would try on foot. And it's not just Haitians. I mean, you had back in the 90s, there were Chinese, there were Russian, there were Eastern European that were coming through because I've had clients that came in from Albania and Kosovo on foot through Mexico. So it's no different. We just see the numbers and are aghast and shocked by it and that, they would be coming through. and Canada and, you know, the United States combined can try to influence or exert a little bit of pressure to get Mexico to get their act together. But, you know, at the same time, it's Mexico's position may be, you know, why should we help you while you're the wealthier nations and what are we going to get from it? Because people come through our, you know, our borders all the time, whether it's for tourism or for trade or for anything else. So, yes, there may be strength in numbers in doing that and getting a coordinated effort to manage the region, whether it's through, you know, the Pan-American, you know, council or committees. You know, the Caribbean also has an alliance where they primarily work together, but for trade, not so much for domestic concerns or social issues, but that is something to consider, and every nation has a degree of immigrants that are legal and illegal that are trying to get in or stay and utilize resources. So, you know, it's reasonable to expect that as a region, if we have trade compacts and treaties and agreements, that we can also have an understanding. But how much of, you know, people's lives can you control with a treaty that's on a macro level versus on an individual level? You have people coming in and they just decide that, you know, Brownsville or El Paso, Texas is going to be it, and then you have a governor of that state that's going to racial profile, and not everybody that's brown skin may be from Haiti or illegal, because some people are born in Texas, raised in Texas, and are, you know, U.S. citizens, and then they were, you know, questioning birth certificates, you know, based on, you know, midwives that were registered or authorized to perform births. So, you know, it's one of those conundrums, and it's a human crisis, and it's a human problem that even the United Nations High Commission for Refugees is trying to get involved with, to say, okay, what can we do according to international law, and then, you know, the boots on the ground, how are you going to man your borders and be humane and dignified without, you know, shooting people at random because you have vigilantes that, you know, can't identify or know what people are coming across and why. They're just concerned with, okay, protecting livestock, protecting their borders, and keeping, you know, COVID out, because the perception is that immigrants are bringing COVID in, and there's nothing further from the truth. But it's just one of those conundrums that I don't know what the answer is. But yes, could we work together more? Definitely. With, you know, all three countries and deciding how to manage the crisis and the human issue. But if we in the United States can't get certain fundamentals together, then we're going to perpetually have a problem. And we have disagreements between Congress members about what is the correct and right path forward. And until we get that, I think we're going to be stuck.
In your opinion, in the, I guess you could say, 9 months that the Biden administration has been in office, what do you see as the pros and cons in terms of how they've handled this border crisis?
Well, I know that there's always going to be criticism of anybody that is in office. So with that said, you know, a lot of the pros is that they are trying to manage by dispatching individuals to utilize diplomatic means, such as the one that you explained, you know, the ambassador to Mexico talking with Mexican officials, our vice president, Kamala Harris, going to talk with some of the representatives from the Central American governments to find out, you know, how they can also stem the tide and create good infrastructure resources and policing of their own borders to keep people in. But, you know, on the other hand, it's also trying to please the American population and the members of Congress that the Biden administration is accountable to, because we do have a system of checks and balances. And so trying to balance all those, you know, within the 9 months, it's like a good start. He's not going to please everybody. Some people are still upset that, you know, the Remain in Mexico policy is still in effect, but that has to do with more the judicial branch saying that, you know, you need to maintain Title 42, which says that because of the public health crisis, we're not going to let any and everybody in. We're going to try to process them, but it's a good thing that they stay abroad until we have the personnel or the mechanism in place to identify who is coming in. So, you know, the pros is they're making diligent efforts at diplomatic channels to resolve from the source of the influx, but on the cons would be they're trying to maintain, you know, peace in our own Congress and the domestic tranquility to keep anti-immigrant advocates, you know, appeased. So I think trying to straddle the two fences is where we find the most challenge, and you can't please everybody. And I think he just needs to start making, you know, what his directives are, which is to treat people with dignity and humanity. He's trying to reconnect some of the kids that were separated from their families, so that's a good thing. He's trying the diplomatic efforts. That's a good thing. They're rewriting policy when it comes to overturning some of the asylum laws to allow people to peaceably come in and submit their applications. They're extending some of the policy initiatives for adjudications of applications, like extending how long police clearances could be effective for and the medical records when it comes to submitting applications, but still trying to deal with the asylum process and system that our last administration was trying to eradicate and eliminate altogether. And I think if, you know, I tell people if they focus on helping people and being systemized and prioritize human dignity, then I think you'll get farther than if you're focused on, like every other administration, fraud and pleasing everybody and anti-immigration rhetoric and policies, then you can move forward. But you will always have people that are going to criticize, that are going to distract, that are going to upend or undermine the process overall. And those voices either have to be silenced or dealt with and, you know, reasoned with, because they're kind of on the fringe when you talk about the course of human history and what we are to be to one another, regardless of our borders.
Nadine, can you address who gets prioritized? What is, you know, what is the consideration I come in? Does it matter what country I come in from? I know there's, you know, of course, you want me to come in legally, but beyond that, how much does it matter what my circumstances are?
So, it's such a broad realm when it comes to immigration, but the people who have priority are going to be connected to U.S. citizens. You had asked me about the, you know, the pullout of Afghanistan and kind of the crisis there, and you see the news feeds, and it's very troubling and disturbing, and it's shocking to a certain extent, but the priority for who we're going to help are people who have been processed, one, but before that are going to be connected to U.S. citizens. So if they have, you have dual nationals, or if you have people who are immediate relatives of U.S. citizens, you're always going to have priority. So spouses and minor children of U.S. citizens get priorities, and then everybody else comes after that. People who have gained permanent residency through a spouse that's a U.S. citizen or through employment because they're highly skilled workers, they get priorities. There are processes through the visa categories where individuals of certain nations have more priority than others, and it's just because of the visa allotments that are designated through Congress, who can get a visa, who cannot, and through the Immigration Nationality Act. So first it's immediate relatives of U.S. citizens, and then immediate relatives of permanent residents, and then it's, you know, skilled workers, and then after that it's anyone who may can get a visa and show that they still have ties to their country of origin. But there are a lot of people that are coming in just because they think they can, or they don't know the law, or they don't care about the law, or they don't have an understanding of the process that is required. There are people who also obtain status through the visa lottery. I mean, we give a certain number of visas out to individuals across the globe who apply and just randomly get selected. As long as they have a high school diploma and they're not a security risk, then they can submit an application, pay a fee, be processed, pass the, you know, medical, physical, and come in that way. So there are lower priorities, and there's numbers of people who get visas, and it may be 5 or 10,000 per fiscal year, which is from October to October. So there's a priority system in place. How effective it is just, you know, what resources we have, physical workers to process the applications, the integration of the system to do the security background checks. And with the pandemic, I tell everybody that embassies have been closed in general. They're just processing, you know, applications one at a time. There have been workflow disruptions on top of the usual delays with immigration. You know, people not completing the forms properly. At one point, there was, and that was a policy issue, where they were rejecting applications because somebody left a blank space. If you did not put not applicable, unknown, or none, then your application was rejected. Then you would have to resubmit, and that caused a delay in the processing of work authorizations or whatnot. So in addition to the system that has been put in place currently by, you know, Congress, you know, ages ago, and that's incorporated in the policy manuals and memoranda that has been issued since by every Department of Homeland Security director and the Attorney General and the Department of Justice, you know, there is a process and there is a system. It's how efficient it has been that becomes problematic. And then when you have world events, natural disasters, global pandemics, you know, people in crises, that strains that system is why we have kind of where we are, and then you have policy disagreements on the floor of Congress about what changes to make or to implement. That becomes, you know, this behemoth of a problem and conundrum that we're trying to figure our way forward through.
When we come back from our final break, I'm going to ask Nadine Brown about DACA and the latest with that. And if you have questions, the number is 516-387-1944. This is the Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment, and we will be right back.
Hi, I'm Jim Garrison, and I think I found a way to help you understand what is Chill Out Jazz.
Some of y'all may be confused because of the style we choose. We make jazz and R&B. We don't categorize. We just make what sound good, baby.
Is it jazz?
It is what it is.
Is it R&B?
Tune in every Wednesday night at 10 on KHAM Radio.
This is Douglas Dobbs, owner and funeral director at Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community with two generations of family funeral service. With the recent addition of my son Brandon, we are here to take care of the needs of Central and West Orlando. From simple cremation to a full burial, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here to help you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Hi there. Welcome back this Friday afternoon to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. Here with Nadine Brown, immigration attorney here in Central Florida. And if you have questions in the last few minutes that we're on, the number is 516-387-1944. Nadine, okay, what's the latest with DACA? Because, I mean, I know we've got the stuff that's going on in the border, but I mean, I keep seeing these stories every now and then about people who have been here since childhood through no fault of their own, imported back to a country where they were born, but they know nothing about, can't speak the language, don't have, you know, anybody there that they can, you know, go to that they can call home. Tell me a little bit about what's going on with DACA.
So DACA applications are still being processed. If they're individuals who have been deported, it's because they have violated their status in other ways. So just because you're in DACA, which is deferred action for childhood arrivals does not mean that you cannot be deported. Deferred action status means that you're in temporary status. You get work authorization. It's based on the fact that you've been physically present in the United States, without leaving, since your initial arrival. You're not able to convert your status to a green card because you came, quote-unquote, illegally or without a visa or entry permit. So those who arrived as children accompanied by their parents typically may have lost their entry documents or don't have entry documents because they came without a passport or came across the border, but who had graduated high school or college. Those are individuals who are eligible and also who don't pose a security risk or have, good police clearance. So if an individual has been deported and they were DACA, that means that they either committed a crime for which they could be deportable, and typically those are theft crimes, weapons possessions or discharging weapons or other criminal activities for which they had been prosecuted and adjudicated either by a jury or by a judge. So, people need to understand that the beauty of America, love or hate, is that we do have due process, and you get, your day in court. You may not get great representation. You may not get any representation, but you at least have an opportunity to present your case, usually before a trier of fact, which is a jury of, quote, unquote, your peers, which may not be your peers, but 12 individuals who are registered voters or six, depending on the type of case that it is. So if you've been, deported, unfortunately, or you've been told that you need to be deported, is because of some other violation that has occurred, not just because you came undocumented and you graduated and are otherwise a good citizen. Because most of our, and citizen in the broad sense, most of our DACA applicants and recipients are law-abiding citizens who, but for the fact that they arrived without documentation and cannot then convert their status to a green card, could be here and get work authorization. So applications are being submitted, and a lot of times it's, not just the 800,000 or a million or so people that have been here, but a lot of times people don't get the information that they need, so they may not have been aware that they were eligible for DACA, or they were afraid to submit an application, because once you do get your name and information in the system, there is always a risk, whether large or small, that at some point, having been fingerprinted, you could be deported if the Congress were to determine, okay, they're going to end DACA, although it was by executive order, or the courts decide that, whatever laws get changed or manipulated or converted to we're going to deport you all, they could potentially be deported. But we're still getting a flood of new applicants who may not have previously applied versus individuals who we already know were DACA recipients and are just renewing every 2 years their work authorization so that they can continue to contribute to society and be in all, types of professions and contribute and pay their taxes and buy houses and do what, other individuals who are U.S. citizen born or naturalized are able to do.
Okay. I have a question about the vice president's role in the border issue and, her being, I guess, publicly assigned to deal with it. Was she, encouraged to take on a role there because we maybe just did we not have an ambassador at the time?
I think it was probably a PR issue, public relations, because she's a child of immigrants. She's a person of color. She's, a woman. On many levels, a lot of the immigrants that are coming are women and children. So you have to, that aspect is good for her to probably interact and show the degree of compassion that the United States could have. So that's on one level. And the second level is, she's essentially a spokesperson for the administration. And so she's trying to extend an olive branch to the governors of those border states and also to Mexico and to Central America to say, okay, here, I want to first understand the problem before we can try to resolve or fix the problem. So I think on those two levels, you know, a degree of diplomacy and then also the image that you are presenting that we are welcoming and we understand that it's a lot of women and children and brown women and children that are trying to get to the U.S. And here we have a representative who kind of understands or is in tuned to what your needs may be. So I think for that purpose she was sent, and because, you know, whether it's people through the State Department, because it had been decimated under the previous administration, because why do diplomacy when you've got, you know, weapons and you're making nice with, you know, people who are launching missiles just because they can in North Korea. So there was all of that. So it's a gesture, I believe, and an effort on one level to try to resolve the crisis. And because it's not something that had been done before, it was just let's create these tent cities and name it migrant protection protocols and remain in Mexico, and we're going to try to process people when you have decimated the asylum offices and officers, and applications were piling up, and there was like no efforts made to really process the people other than just keep them out. So I think the Biden administration installing, you know, our vice president to go and at least try to fact find and see what can be done was helpful on one level, but it's just a start. And like you said, it's 9 months in. We have, what, several years to go to see what actually manifests as far as policy and reduction in the numbers. But a lot of that also has to do with information that is promoted and provided to foreign nations and their populations about what we can and cannot do for them.
One of the reasons I ask is I guess I expected, I don't know, something a little more visible in terms of what her role is or I guess what, I'll just say what I expected it to be or what I thought it should have been. So, you know, were my expectations, like, just a little bit elevated, or what?
I think, you know, a lot of times we have the perception, a lot of people were riding the wave that, okay, a new administration means a lot of change, but we still have the same system of government that we had from, you know, the 1780s and 90s, which is it's a checks and balances, and as much as we elect a president, it's a representative democracy, and so each of us, when we vote, we're not just, it's not just one man, one voter, one woman, one vote, but we're casting a ballot for a representative who is going to Congress to present, you know, our opinions or positions on certain things that matter to us, whether it's commerce and how we are taxed or what our tax dollars are used for the general welfare. So as much as we will elect a president and vice president, that's great. They can, by executive order, create some policies, which are good, but those can be undone by our local representative or our Congress people that we each vote into office when we tick off our ballot, or our state senators, and we're allowed two senators, and that's why the fight in the Senate and the, you know, the House of Representatives making bills, which is great, but if the Senate does not then take it up, revise, or pass it, then it does not become a law, and if our president vetoes the law or is not in alliance with the legislation, then it also gets mm-hmm. nixed, and then we also have a judiciary which can interpret the laws that Congress makes or that the president mm-hmm. makes if it's ever challenged. So our checks and balances is what keeps our government going or not going, and our positions, you know, our positions either yeah. are promoted or not. So, yeah, it would be nice if Kamala and Joe with magic beans and, you know, their charisma
right.
able to make changes,
yeah.
but we still yeah. have to vote in our elections, local and federal.
Nadine, have a wonderful and blessed weekend. Thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
Thank you so much for having me. Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you all for listening. Have a blessed weekend. Go out and plant that garden. Vegetables are getting expensive. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. Be well, be safe, be blessed. And please remember, all real power comes from God. Take care.
Thank you.
He'll make it all right.